So, welcome to Whiskey Congress. On the phone with us is Michael Wood Jr. Mike is a friend of ours from a long time ago, calling in from Los Angeles, California. First of all, friend, thanks for calling in. It's good to hear from you.
Thanks for having me. And you know what? I got to say real quick, it feels super weird to hear you say that I'm in L.A.
Okay.
You're big time in us now. Yeah. You're Hollywood, officially.
So,
all right.
I mean, it might sound weird, but it's still true. So you got that. I got that going for me in this case. So when we did our last Steve and Jim Fix the World While Drinking show, you had some comments. I might as well just open the door and let you get them out there.
Also, is this like our first Whiskey Congress
episode? It's part of the launch.
Yeah, I feel so honored and privileged to be part of the launch of the Whiskey Congress of something I never, hardly ever drink. So,
but when you were in my house, you did drink some. So you're
right. I mean, it was my price of admission. It was like,
exactly.
That's pretty much the price of admission for everybody that comes into this house. Just so you know.
Okay. Well, I mean, I'm always getting on people with the gun issues. I don't even know how I got into these gun arguments. I think really Rogan was the first person that got me to say the gun arguments, and then ever since I opened my mouth about the gun arguments, I've been having the damn gun argument. But that being said, I heard when I listened to you guys some of the things I was hoping to maybe guide you on a different path or maybe allow you to explain a little bit more of what you were trying to say. So let's see where we start off. Are you buzzing me out?
No, we're not buzzing you out. I got a text message. I'm sorry.
I thought you were like, we're not hearing this.
No. I mean, look, in the past we've talked about this. I've said nothing you've said is wrong. I don't always like what you're saying, but that doesn't make you wrong. I just don't happen to like it from a personal, like, personal habit standpoint.
Well, and I guess for the one thing, so Jim showed me the exchange between you two, and so I guess my question to you is, you know, you said that our first four points were wrong, and so where were we wrong? Because my thought is that, one, there's a ton of guns out there. I mean, there's almost one gun for every person in the country, and it's owned by a small percentage of the people in the country, but that small percentage of people are not willingly going to give those guns up. And that's kind of like where we start.
Yeah, that's fine. I don't really argue with that. The first thing you said was that the law does not say comply or die. And yeah, it absolutely does say comply or die. That's what policing is. It is the enforcement. It is violence. I don't care if you're talking about a traffic ticket. If you do not comply, it ends in your death. So if you want to unpack that, or are you comfortable with accepting that?
No, actually. I would like to unpack that more because I think I know where you're going with it, but I do want you to extrapolate on it a little bit more.
Yeah, so that is the point of any law, and that is the fundamental reason why police are armed, because the concept is if you do not listen, this will escalate until you listening and use of force being applied, and that use of force from resisting arrest will escalate to death if you do not comply somewhere along the line, even if it's a traffic ticket.
Fair enough, but I mean, in the case of Philando Castile, I don't know that there was any non-compliance there.
But then that's a different argument.
True.
comply or not.
There's degrees, though, right? I mean, if I'm unarmed and being a jerk, and I get tasered or, you know, billy clubbed, okay.
Taser is less lethal, though. You can die from a taser. It happens all the time. So that was the application of die.
So I see where you're going, and I get what you're saying, and you're actually absolutely right. Because ultimately, a police officer has to make the judgment call. And in most states, it's written out where if a police officer feels that you are in the commission of a crime or a felony or something, they all have it written different ways. But it's written almost in every community and every police force that's out there that they eventually get to the point where they can use lethal force, right? Like, I mean, at some point in time on the books across the board in every police force, all their ordinances and how they operate, it gets to this is what you can do to use lethal force, and the description across the board is pretty generic and subjective, right?
Right.
Okay. So I guess that's where you're saying, you know, you're just taking all the middle out and just saying it is actually comply or die. You're just taking the short path to get there.
Yeah, I mean, it can be a long path. It could be years of a path, but that is the path.
Okay.
So, and then Jim said the thing that we just can't get past in our society, the perception that police have a dangerous job, and they just don't. If you want to look at it objectively and look at the numbers, we know the numbers. It's not a dangerous job. It's a scary job, maybe, but not dangerous.
Okay. I mean, you're a data guy. I know that in the, you know, if you look at like most dangerous jobs in the country, catching king crab is infinitely more many times more dangerous than being a police officer. But I say that, and I try to say that out of respect, Mike. Maybe I'm being too deferential, but I accept that it's fair enough. It's scary job might be a better word than dangerous job, because depending on where you are and what you're doing, I mean, if you're working, you know, Chicago Vice, it's probably a bit more dangerous than,
suburban Cleveland.
Suburban Cleveland. I was about to drop.
No. I'm gonna. That's absolutely not true either. The most dangerous thing a cop does is the same thing that everybody does: is drive a vehicle. So, the most cops die out in rural areas because they hit a freaking deer or something. I mean, the job is actually just as dangerous no matter where you are. I thought myself that the job was way less dangerous and felt that way in Baltimore because my backup was a fraction of a second away. The world's best hospital was 10 blocks down the street. So, I don't know. I mean, objectively, I don't think it's that dangerous.
Well, I mean, you're certainly more qualified to speak on that than me, so thanks for clarifying that.
Well, hold on. And so, I guess, and this is why I enjoy talking to you, because you force me to think. And so I think part of it is social conditioning, right? We've been socially conditioned to believe and give deference to and give praise to police officers because of the dangers, because of the risks, because they can point to and say that a police officer died in the line of duty. And, it, you know, the percentages of officers that die is a lot smaller than the percentage of the number of people that police officers kill in a year. So,
right.
And so when you start to extrapolate that out, some of this stuff is just things that we've been conditioned to say over the years, you know, since we were kids.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah, I think so too. I felt that, but then when I actually did the job, I really felt like when I heard about cops in Pennsylvania that worked in this area out in the hicks, in the sticks with these crazy NRA guys. I was throwing a little jab there. And
if you've heard me talk about the NRA, you know that's good.
Yeah, we're going there next. But if you're a state trooper out in PA and your backup is 45 minutes away, I was like, that shit is scary.
I can totally understand that line of thinking. I don't know that we've ever had this conversation. I think I've had it with Steve, though. I think you know that I'm a concealed concealed carry permit holder in Ohio. The only times I carry is when I'm going off in the sticks to go fishing. I live in the city of Cleveland. I don't feel afraid here. But when I'm in the middle of nowhere and know that if something goes wrong, I am completely on my own, that's when I'm the most nervous.
Yeah, and I get that. So the person in the suburbs that has to have their shotgun, hey, you're not going to get a pushback from me. I totally get it. Jim, I really appreciate your comments about the NRA and then you too, Steve. So I'm glad you guys caught that point, and I wanted to point that out about how the NRA is just bullcrap.
Yeah, I mean, their complete lack of response in the Philando Castile case is not surprising, but to me very exposing, because look, that's the guy you're supposed to be representing if you take away skin color, and that's pretty much all I can say about that.
Yep, totally agree.
You know, and what's interesting is that, you know, on our last show, I was saying how there was a guy Mike, are you familiar with Colin Noir at all?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. He's a NRA spokesperson.
Oh, yeah. I know you're talking about.
Yeah. And so at that point, I hadn't seen anything from him. He did end up doing an open letter. I would love to take credit for it that we motivated him to do it, but that is not the case. He penned an open letter that talked about an experience that he had. And the letter really didn't, it wasn't a great response, right? He said it happened and Philando Castile should be alive. But he backstopped it and hedged a lot of it with a lot of the common NRA rhetoric. So it was a response. It wasn't great. It wasn't the worst, which is probably why they had him do it instead of Wayne LaPierre. But it was a response. I don't think it really changes the three of us, I don't think it changes our opinion. It was too little, too late. And it really goes to show what they're really all about, right? This is nothing to do with actually gun rights for everyone. It's gun rights for a specific group of people for a specific reason to continue to allow the gun manufacturers to cash in.
And for that lobbying organization to continue to drag money out of people with amazing success.
Yeah. So, I mean, go ahead. Totally agree on that. So we're moving on to the next thing.
Let's go.
Which was, you guys got into the, if you take away guns, then people will use cars and knives and things like that. No, like, you guys totally will accept that that means a hell of a lot less deaths, right? So the goal was always less deaths, not zero. We're not going to get to zero.
Understand. You know, Mike, I don't know what my BAC was at the time that was said. I know that that argument is bullshit. Now, my big point is that it's a long process. If you're going to say, you know what, you America, we're treating you like Australia, you've proven you're not mature enough to have guns, you could certainly make that argument. And I know your argument is, if you restrict things to bolt action rifles and pump shotguns, that you would reduce gun violence dramatically. No argument there. It just happens to dent my personal collection, so that's my only...
Mike, let me ask you this. What are your thoughts regarding gun violence in inner cities, in predominantly black and Hispanic neighborhoods, in relation to, okay, if we take guns away and we outlaw handguns and all these other guns and we get them completely out, you know, we say you can't have these, how do you think that impacts what happens, you know, in our inner cities, some of the stuff that we're trying to clean up?
I mean, you guys know my PhD work is in management. It's not in policing. So I'm looking at this in supply and demand, and I'm saying a lot of gangbangers start getting rich selling guns to white people.
And vice versa.
No, it's going to go the other way around, because remember, gangbangers and people in cities that are resorting to gun violence, they're doing this because they do not have resources and opportunities. So once you make that gun more valuable, the longer they hold on to it and preserve it, as the gun will become more and more valuable. So I would think they'd be holding on to them, because why would you use that to try and shoot somebody when this thing's going to be incredibly valuable going forward?
Well, a long time ago on this show, and there's a gun shop in Indianapolis called Don's Guns, and that guy basically...
Yeah, I watched all those videos after you told me to. They're ridiculous.
Fucking scary, isn't it? I mean, that guy might as well say, I want to pump as many guns into the ghetto as I can. They're cheap, they're fun, have a gun. I mean, he might have used those exact words.
It's unbelievable. Mike, there's a few things that I want to throw out at you, because I want to hear you talk about them a little bit more. And there are some common narratives that are thrown out. People get into these kind of traps of saying these things. And I'd like you to talk about them. The one thing you hear commonly when we're talking about policing, and I'm kind of transitioning us, because I do want to get to the Philando Castile situation. You know, one of the things you hear often is, you know, it's only a small percentage of the police that are bad, and they're making the rest of the police officers that are good look bad. What are your thoughts when you hear someone, you know, kind of raise that statement?
Right. So, I mean, people can look at some of the videos that I've done expanding upon this more. Well, the thing is like, for that, if you're looking at it in that narrow window, yeah, they're right. But this isn't what we're talking about. This isn't about individual cops. This is about a system that sets the stage for cops to do things that are occupying forces and going against the people. And what policing actually does is one of three things. And I know people are going to have to expand upon that later and figure out the nuance to it. But it's the creation and maintenance of a slave class, and then the extraction of resources from that oppressed class in order to fuel their own oppression. So what that has evolved to today to look like is regressive taxation, like tickets and citations and bails and things like that that police are focused on in poor neighborhoods. And then when those people can't pay those kind of bills, because a $45 fine to somebody that makes $12,000 a year is incredibly significant, so they can't make these things, and then that money is funneled into the policing, and then so the police are funneled by tax paying and like civil asset forfeiture and things like that to fuel the continued oppression of that class. The second thing they do is the protection of elite property, the property of the rich, essentially. So an easy way to think about this is in modern-day form, if you look at the uprising in Baltimore, you will see that you can look at the pictures of the CVS burning, and the cops are lined up around the CVS, protecting the CVS. Meantime, the entire whole incident, the only person that ever died was Freddie Gray, and that was the creation and maintenance of the slave class in the first step. So the third thing that the police do in America, this isn't a worldwide thing, this is unique to America, is the continued genocide of the Native American people. And what that looks like today is state-sanctioned agents in Standing Rock serving the will of the private corporations of the energy transfer partners and assaulting citizens, using force against peaceful citizens, and extracting those resources from that tax base to continue to fuel those things that nobody in that area wants to occur. So we have to change that stage, because no matter how good the person is, when you put them into this type of a situation, they're an apple that's going into a rotten barrel. And whether they're aware of it or not, or whether they take proactive action or not, this barrel will poison them in everything that they do.
Okay. Very, very well said. So, and if I was going to say that another way, I could say that the system is so stilted towards that kind of behavior that even good people coming in are pushed in that direction. And what, regardless of the number of quote unquote bad apples, those apples are going to flourish.
Right. So an easy way, another way to look at this on a personal incident is, so we have a racist system and institution in policing. And so when I went into policing, I went in, I wanted the fun and all, but I wasn't out to hurt anybody. I didn't have a racist bone in my body. But I spent 11 years being a state-sanctioned agent who was out oppressing people, and I didn't realize it. Like, my actions were racist actions. And it took a while to think about that, because I was being sent there to gather quotas and to do these things, and I was sent to these areas, so I'm just following the orders. This is where I get sent. I don't think about why I'm there and what this actually does in a neighborhood until a long time of observing and thinking about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I have to wonder, and this is, I guess, more of a personal question, and I think we know the answer, right? Because we see what you're doing now. But, once you realize that, what was your response to that? Like, all of a sudden you woke up, you had the Tamir White situation, which I think sparked some things for you, if I remember correctly. And that realization, what was that moment for you? What was that like?
Well, I probably spent 12 years trying to be like the perfect cop, and so to understand the law, to understand how police should behave, the best practices, and how you interact with the public. But the idea that if we were professional, what we have lacked was professionalism. So if we could be perfect and professional at this, then we would improve ourselves. But in that process of learning and trying to figure out how to do that, I realized we had a management issue. So I ended up doing my PhD, or I started my master's in management. And then when I was doing that, you learn about systems and incentives and disincentives, and corporations are structured a certain way so that they have a certain output. And these things happen regardless of what the employees intend. It's because it's built into the system. And so when I took those concepts and applied them over to policing, why the hell that hasn't been done before? Somebody needs to talk to scholars about. But anyway, when I took and applied them over to policing, and you trace back what your incentives and disincentives within the system are, it means that your employees are going to act in this incredibly racist manner, whether they intend to or not. It's because of the policies and practices in place.
Oh,
so you got to fix it, you know. So at that point, I had to fix it, and that's what led me to developing the civilian-led policing model, which is my best effort right now by going through the literature and what we know about criminal justice, what I know from my career, and really more so what we know about corporate social responsibility theory and power structures within organizations and how that would apply over to policing, creating a system which would actually serve the people and fund their goals. Because protect and serve in this system means protect and serve that rich elite, the politicians, and four-year goals. If we change protect and serve to the people perpetually, then we will have a system that's always fighting to reduce these kind of problems.
Now, Mike, I have a question about your system and you know, the civilian... the civilian aspect of it—that's managing the actual police force. How do you keep them from being? How do you keep the civilian entity of your model from being corrupted over time by whether it's you know, money or just kind of the swell of power? Like, how do you kind of combat that? Within, how do you build into the system a way to kind of help try to prevent the corruption that we see in other kind of aspects of government?
Yeah, sure. So this is probably was my biggest hurdle, and it would be my biggest area to ask if anybody wanted to contribute to continuing to improve that concept to do so. So we have a bunch of mitigating factors built in, and it's probably the best example of this system is the answer to this question, because the idea is that you reference the people and you get down to the people what they actually want of a system, what their thoughts are. And that's what I was doing in Baltimore. Is I was at a cookout in front of the CVS. It was like maybe it was a year after the CVS had burned during the uprising. It had something to do with that. And we were sitting at a grill. This guy, Shorty, Dwayne Davis from Baltimore, he's an activist down there. And I was saying this to him, like, I'm having this, I don't know how I get seven people, selected from the population that isn't corruptible and is like an equitable representation, because if we have an election, okay, they're going to get funded by certain people, they're going to get bought. If we have a random selection, well, then you could have a random bunch of rich white people that are going to end up enacting something terrible. So how in the heck do you do this? And he said, oh, it's easy. You just go ahead and you do like a jury pool style, but they have to meet like a qualification to get into that jury pool.
Okay. Yeah, so how often do you rotate that group?
Right. So the way that I started thinking about how we needed to do that. And so the first idea that we need to get in is what qualifies people to be onto the board. We have to have, like, we can't have people that don't know anything be on the board. So the critical element here is you don't need to know anything to be on this board. What you need to know how to do is how to arrive at truth. Because we're going to have all the resources in the world. If you want to ask how you should properly handle a suspect or you should properly run some level of management when you're in charge of this thing, then you can call in all the professors from the colleges there. They're going to be participating anyway, and you can get the best minds around to give you their information. But how do you know what's the best thing to do? How can you sort through that? Well, all we have to do is a month-long online MIT would easily do something like this, where you have a critical thinking class. And people have to take the class online, and register, sign up, volunteer to do it, and you have a bunch of other mitigating factors built in, like maybe 25 and over. You can have They have to be residents of the city for at least 5 years, so you get people that are truly invested in it. You can have, an algorithm is what we want to say. Like, I don't know how we best go about that. We need to bring in some different scholars to look at it. But we need a system that weights it towards the shareholders, because this is built off of corporate social responsibility theory and stakeholder theory, and that means that whoever has the most interactions with the police has the most say in the board and who is selected. So this selection of the board has to be weighted towards areas and the shareholders who have the most investment in it. And what that will end up doing is making it so that the people who live in the areas that have the most police attention, then they will be they'll be incredibly more likely to end up being on the board. So then you have that balancing effect of whoever is getting the pressure from the state, they end up having the most say in what the police do, so that they will make laws that will protect themselves. And when they make laws that will protect themselves, whenever we protect the bottom, we make rules that protect all of us. So that has a mitigating effect. You have the concept that this is like a two-year board. So as you rotate people through on a two-year basis, who is going to sign up and take a $80,000 a year job for 2 years that's full-time, that's going to completely take up your life? Only people that really want to do it. If you have a $250,000 a year job, you're not going to volunteer to give that up to go take an $80,000 a year job for 2 years. So you have all these kind of things, and whatever other people can think of, we'll add it in.
Okay.
And I like that idea, and I like the two-year rotation is key. It's a big part of it, because, you know, you have someone in that position for too long. And I think that's one of the issues that we see in government across the board, is people are able to sit there for 4 years, 6 years, 8 years, 12 years, 20 years. You know, you have these representatives in Congress that have been there for, you know, my entire life. So I think that's a huge part of it, is limiting the amount of time, which forces, like, all right, you're going to take this job. If you're going to take it, that means that you're passionate about it. So in that time that you're there, you're more motivated to get more done, right?
Right. I mean, there's a whole bunch of, we can talk to psychologists and figure out all different ways to completely fine tune it, but it's also very particular to the area, which is a kind of a hard concept for people to get when we say, well, what would civilian policing look like in my neighborhood? And what we have to understand is civilian-led policing is like the table that you can put your ideas on. The thing is you don't have a table to put your ideas on. I'm only trying to give you the table, and whatever ideas you guys put on it, we'll argue about the merit of those ideas and fine-tune that to your area and what matters in your city, because every city is unique in its culture and what's important to it. So, like, for instance, Cleveland is on the Bay, and you have the Hard Rock Cafe, and you have a certain culture evolved there, and that's not going to be like what you have in Baltimore, where, yes, you're on the Bay, but you have, like, a dirt bike culture. Well, the policing in Baltimore should embrace and tune themselves to that dirt biking culture and find a way to embrace it in a positive manner, and that wouldn't necessarily apply to what Cleveland would do. So it's fine. You've got to fine-tune it after we build the table.
I got you. And I think that's one thing where, you know, I've obviously we follow you on Twitter, and that's the thing that I think people, when they kind of engage you on this, that they don't understand, is that this is a concept in every sense of the word, and a framework, and it can be, you know, fashioned to and made specific to and tailored to, you know, and it should be to your local community. And I think that's where, you know, the confusion is. People say, hey, you know, Mike, give us this model so we can apply it. And I think your whole, you know, where you start to push back is just like, listen, this is only the beginning. You and your local city are going to have to do the legwork to figure out how this is going to work best for your situation.
Yeah, exactly. And I'll come help you, and we can all push through those weeds together. But if my system works, you don't need me, and I shouldn't need to be some power structure within it. This shouldn't have anything to do with me. I should be a signature at the bottom of the piece of paper that says, yes, this is the model, go ahead and run with it. Like, it can't be about me and these minor issues. These are your cities, and that's the point, is that you're taking over your police department to be accountable for its actions. and that's also a scary thing for us to think about, that like humans, we want to look to the authority figure. And it's like, I'm trying to use, like, when they look at me, I'm trying to say, like, that's actually kind of like the problem that I'm trying to push back on. It isn't look at me.
Right, right. It's really one of those situations where people need to take responsibility for their own communities to get the result that they're looking for, right, which is, right. Which is change.
If this system is right, like I say, and then I'm going to espouse this theory, that also means when I'm pushing back on some people who have police reform measures, the reason I will push back on every single police reform measure is because you are doing it within that rotten barrel. And so whatever you're trying to do, you're just like, maybe you're putting some water out of it. Maybe, you know, you're shining up the apples really good before you put them into the rotten barrel. But no matter what you put into that barrel, if it's body cameras, then that means when you put body cameras into that barrel, the police take them over, it becomes a tool. The next thing you know, they have it attached to facial recognition and they're running warrant checks on everybody like they're already planning to do. And now you push for body cameras and now you create a state of mass surveillance because you are trying to fix something that cannot be fixed.
You know, I've been a big proponent for body cameras and dash cams for a long time. And my logic was, if we have that information, then this issue will get a light shined upon it and it'll get better. And I think half of that's true. There's a light shined upon it, but it really hasn't gotten better. I mean, Philando Castile is a perfect example of, you've got video evidence of what happened. You don't need to take someone's word for it. You don't need to hear he said, she said. You can see it, and still it gets treated the way it did. And that one to me was, I mean, there's been a bunch of examples, and it's kind of sad that a lot of times Steve and I will talk about a wrongful death shooting and say, oh, that happened there. Oh, wait. Oh, is that the... they start to run together because they're not aberrations. They're frequent occurrences.
And I think it traumatizes all of us in a mass way. Like, it's either going to numb you or it becomes like violence porn to people. And like, I have to review these things constantly to make these videos and talk about it. And it's just like, it leaves a dark cloud hanging over you. And so, like, I get pissed when people are fighting for the wrong things because they're just not, like, thinking about this radically enough to really take charge of our societies.
Radical change or complete shifts are something we suck at in America. We don't take bold steps to change things. I mean, a totally different...
Well, I don't know if I agree with that. I mean, this country is actually built on radical change. I mean, the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, the Civil Rights Movement. We've had radical change. It just... Now, I think we've definitely gotten soft compared to where we were. And But I think, to Michael's point, is that we need more people to move in that radical direction. But it needs to be... a well-thought-out, controlled radicalism. Like, you can't just fly off the handle and go protest everything. It has to be... My whole position is that it's got to be strategic. There's got to be a purpose, and you have to have a plan and a solution. And going out and just being pissed and yelling isn't enough.
I want to totally agree with that.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen so much of that. I'm gonna put on a hat and... carry a sign, well, that's great, but if you don't have an objective and an achievable objective, it's...
Right, and one of the instances, what happened at Standing Rock, I use that as an example of that there was a specific objective there. There was a reason why you guys were there. You knew exactly what that objective was, and to some degree, you achieved it. Now, Trump was elected, and then things, you know, have been, you know, put into flux, but that was an example of how and why you protest. I think a lot of the strategy that you guys used in that instance in North Dakota, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Was it just, you don't see that with a lot of these different protests. And I get that people are angry and frustrated, but they have to harness that anger, they have to harness that frustration and really start to channel it into strategy if any sort of movement is going to be successful. Because right now, the monster that we're up against with systemic racism in our criminal justice system and even to our financial system to a certain degree, it's a monster that's grown beyond what we saw in the civil rights movement with Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. The monster has evolved and gotten stronger and smarter. And how we fight that monster, our skill set and our tools have to grow and evolve as well.
Yeah, I'm going to completely agree with you. One of the standout incidences is why Philando Castile's killer got let off. And that's because it's legally codified that all he has to do is be in fear. It doesn't have to be reasonable. It just has to be in fear. When they originally did it, I don't know why I can't remember the court case in the beginning that first established it, but what they had established was that if as long as a reasonable officer felt in fear, then they could use deadly force, fear of their life or the life of somebody else, then deadly force would be justified. How that has evolved throughout the years was kind of culminated in Freddie Gray in Baltimore when the officers were tried for his killing. What the courts ended up deciding there was that the average officer was reasonable because they started saying, what would the average officer do? Not what an officer should do or what would a reasonable officer do. So they codified into the case law that a reasonable officer is an average officer. So now that we've gotten standards so low, or maybe we can argue about the why, but we're at this point where the average officer is unreasonable. So if that's the case, then we have now codified that unreasonable fear is a justification for murder.
I mean, the Freddie Gray case is that much more. So from a legal standpoint, the fact that there were six officers involved and they all had separate trials, so proving, you know, cause beyond a reasonable doubt on any one was difficult. And I mean, that was a disgusting case to me in the sense that they kind of backtracked the reason for that fear. He ran, so they tackled him. He ends up dead. And then they said, well, he had a knife. Well, you didn't know he had the knife until you frisked him when he was immobilized. So he was outnumbered 6-1. And I mean, that was just a case of brutality that I don't think they intended to end in death, but when it does, you should be accountable.
I mean, it's a crime of negligence. Maybe there wasn't intent, but yeah, I mean, manslaughter is negligence.
Right. And that's the thing that really, we talked about and really hit me with Philando Castile is if they would have charged that officer with, you know, second degree murder and the charge didn't meet, or the evidence didn't meet the standard of the charge, I would have understood that. They charged him with second-degree manslaughter and with, I forget what they called it, but essentially recklessly discharging a firearm resulting in death or injury. And I'm like, how can you say that's not accurate? And frankly, the idea that this officer doesn't go to jail, his going to jail would not have made me feel any good. It wouldn't have made, you know, that doesn't make me happy. The only thing that I'm looking for, and I think we're all looking for, is accountability. When you give the kind of power that you do to the average police officer, that with that power comes a responsibility, not free reign.
All right, Peter Parker.
Comic book reference.
Here we go. All right.
Well, listen, I mean, Mike, we really want to thank you for calling in. It's been a while. We, like I said, you know, earlier before we got on, we really appreciate what you're doing. You've helped us, you know, kind of think about what we're saying when we are recording our show. Even though sometimes I know we still throw stuff out there and it just drives you nuts.
But we're glad to. I'm glad to. Anyway, I'm not glad to drive you nuts, but I do. I appreciate your feedback.
Right, we appreciate the fact that you listen, and so in that turn, I guess it's kind of, you know, we appreciate the fact that we drive you nuts. But thanks for calling in. Is there anything that are you going to be on? Anything else? Is there anything else that you want to plug so we can get it out there so people know where to find you or listen to you?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm hoping one of the first things that you guys do is join me on the Vans Warped Tour that I'm going to be going on, and Veteran Stan is going on, that's doing an activation.
Ooh, I looked at that. You guys, it's going to be in, are you guys coming Akron. To Canton?
Akron.
Okay.
Yeah. So maybe we can do a live Whiskey Congress from the Vans Warped Tour.
Nice.
So that would be cool. So we're doing that right now, which the premise behind that is one of the things we talked about is when veterans are out as an evolution of Veteran Stand for Standing Rock, and we wanted to create local groups and kind of empower them to fight their issues in their own area. And we wanted to give an example of what that would look like, because one of the hard things in activism is a lot of white saviorness, where they kind of come in with trying to install their ideas and not listening to the people and doing what they can to get their ideas heard. So what I try to do, and been doing for a long time, is to build stages and kind of view that as what we do. So we do the hard work to build a stage so that other voices are heard. So we got this big, huge tent. We're working with the Vans officially going through, and we have a whole stage set up with artists and poets, local artists, national artists coming in to have their voices heard and speak to the kids there. We have two VR systems set up that are art galleries from all over the country. Artists can still send their stuff in. We can attach that to the bottom of this. And that's doing fine. Like some empathy things and games and stuff like that in the VR, because there's all kinds of neat things that you can do with 360 video, like putting people into a protest so that they can see how real it is, or putting people in with the Syrian refugees fleeing. There's a video for that too that we have that people can come and experience. So that's on the Vans Warped Tour, and anybody can come and follow us, and actually they can they can text Transform Tour to 22828, and they can get information on that. That's a cool thing we got set up just the other day. And so we'll be up in Akron, and hopefully we can do that down there. And then a group was formed with some lawyers and hardworking campaign guys from political world who decided they were going to fight and try and get civilian-led policing known and around the world and presented to people around the country, at least at first. And so they're around on the tour too, going to all the cities and meeting with everybody to talk about how they can install civilian-led policing in their particular area in there and catch up with them. And their website is civilianledpolicing.org, and their Twitter is @civilianledpd. So either way you want to go with that.
Fantastic.
All right.
So that's in July?
I don't know. Whatever the schedule says. So the easiest thing would be to
go to those sites.
Look at I've been on the site. I saw it, and I had planned on going. I was going to drag Jim there anyway. Once that gets a little bit closer, we'll absolutely get something together, because we'd love to come out and support you and kind of see what it's about, because it sounds like it's a really interesting time.
Awesome. And the tour's already going on now. It's just. The CEO and I of Veteran Stand will take turns jumping in and out of, so, you know, we can't all be on that tour. Thanks, hard.
Right. Well, yeah. Thank you again. We'll definitely want to catch up when you're in town, and definitely want to support your cause. So,
all right, guys. Awesome, love you, man. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Take care, brother.